From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. LeBron can dunk. Heck, he can attend the ESPYs. And he doesn't have to convince the Cleveland Cavaliers that he's their new starting point guard. Ahead on Only a Game, the tale of LeBron James and several slightly less well-known hoopsters at this week's Summer League Games. And an account of the back-breaking, break-busting Stage 8 of the Tour de France. Also ahead on Only a Game, Tanya Streeter prepares for her latest free-diving record attempt, and a soccer team from the U.S. competes in Austria's homeless World Cup.
I think the reason that the fans, and especially the women, are falling in love with our players is they're seeing our players at their best. Back home, if they were achieving this much, they'd have this many women coming at them.
Stay tuned.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carol Van Dam. The U.S. military says an American soldier was shot and killed while guarding a bank in Baghdad today. The death brings to 149 the number of U.S. soldiers killed in the Iraq War. That is two more than the number of American soldiers killed in the Gulf War of 1991. Two other American servicemen were killed in Iraq yesterday. One soldier died in a town west of Baghdad when an Army Humvee hit a landmine. NPR's Guy Raz reports from the Iraqi capital.
The mounting death toll comes as Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz meets with top U.S. officials in Iraq. Top U.S. officials here who briefed the secretary on his arrival said Wolfowitz appeared less confident than usual. Meanwhile, Paul Bremer, the top U.S. civilian administrator here, is in Washington for a week of talks with senior administration officials. Bremer will also meet with the president. On Friday, two prominent Muslim leaders denounced the U.S.-backed Iraqi Governing Council and demanded national elections. Angry crowds in the Shiite town of Kufa chanted anti-U.S. slogans outside the main mosque. Just outside Baghdad, a Sunni cleric called for the creation of a religious army. Guy Raz, NPR News, Baghdad.
Police in England have searched the home of weapons expert David Kelly a day after he was tentatively identified as the man whose body was found in woods of a village outside of London. Kelly's wife says he was under tremendous stress after testifying about British intelligence on Iraq. Kelly denied being the main source of information discrediting intelligence on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. Police have not released the cause of death. Pentagon officials say the United States has released about two dozen prisoners from the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. NPR's Tom Gelton reports the prisoners are no longer considered a risk to the U.S.
The United States occasionally releases Guantanamo detainees after U.S. authorities conclude the prisoners are no longer a threat to U.S. national security. At the same time, additional prisoners are regularly flown to Guantanamo from other facilities. In the latest such operation, a small number of detainees, fewer than 10, were flown to Guantanamo on Thursday from Afghanistan, according to a defense official. About two dozen Guantanamo detainees were then flown back to Afghanistan. The detainees are Afghans and Pakistanis, according to the official, and their governments took custody of them once they were back in Afghanistan. The transfer took place as U.S. and British authorities were discussing what to do with British prisoners at Guantanamo. The White House, acting on a British request, has agreed to suspend proceedings against two British prisoners who had been set to go before a military tribunal. Tom Gelton, NPR News, the Pentagon.
Thousands of Liberian residents are fleeing toward the center of Monrovia today, running from explosions that shook the capital. Reports say the fighting has come to within 3 miles of Monrovia. Witnesses say militia fighters are retreating. This is NPR. Gay activists throughout South America are celebrating a first for the continent, a civil union between a same-sex couple. Brian Burns reports on Friday's ceremony in Buenos Aires.
Complete with confetti and fireworks, two gay men in Buenos Aires became the first couple ever to complete a civil union in South America. Marcelo Sundheim and Cesar Sigluiti signed the city registry together, ushering in a new era of equal rights for homosexuals in the Argentine capital. It's a real privilege to be here because this is the result of the work of many people from throughout the homosexual community in Argentina, Sundheim told reporters. The new law extends medical and insurance benefits to same-sex couples, but does not allow them to adopt children. The Catholic Church, of which 4 out of 5 Argentines are members, has vowed to oppose plans to offer the civil unions nationwide. For NPR News, I'm Brian Burns in Buenos Aires.
Los Angeles Lakers star Kobe Bryant has released a statement declaring his innocence in the face of a felony sexual assault charge filed against him in Colorado. Bryant says in the statement, "I did not assault the woman who's accusing me. I made the mistake of adultery." Bryant says he must answer to his wife and his God for his actions and prays that both will forgive him. If convicted, the 24-year-old star could get life in prison. A memorial service is planned for early this afternoon in Santa Monica, California, after an elderly man plowed through a farmer's market on Thursday, killing 10 people. More than 45 others were injured when the 86-year-old man plowed through the crowd, and it was an open-air market. Police say it could take up to 3 weeks to finish their investigation of the accident. I'm Carol Van Dam, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Kresge Foundation, building capacity with challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, since 1985 offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. On Monday night, the Nets beat the 76ers 86-80. The Knicks fell to the Bucks 71-76. The Hawks demystified the Wizards 82-50. And no, this is not a recycled story. The aforementioned teams, or at least various excellent players wearing their laundry, have been competing in an NBA summer league at the University of Massachusetts in Boston for the past week. Chris Ford, formerly a head coach for three NBA teams and a newly hired assistant coach for the Philadelphia 76ers, was among those evaluating the efforts of the players.
It's very impressive because, you know, these young guys know that they have a golden opportunity right now to get to the NBA. You know, this is the first step along the path, and it's a big pot of gold there at the end of the rainbow, and it's great to see kids going full tilt.
Actually, some of the runners, jumpers, blockers, and dunkers on display during their alleged off-season have already tapped that pot of gold, at least in a modest sort of way. One of the more impressive members of the summer New Jersey Nets is, in fact, a guy with two seasons in as a Net, Brian Scalabrine. Though he's averaged a little under 3 points a game over the past two seasons, Scalabrine torched the 76ers for a team-high 20 points in the Nets' opening game, which he maintained was no triumph.
For me, it's not about proving something. For me, it's about coming out here and winning the game. When we practice with the team, we don't work on, you know, me trying to prove something or the next guy trying to prove something. We work on trying to do the best that we can win, and hopefully I can do my job and we can come up with a win.
In the victory over the 76ers Monday night, the 6'9" red-haired Scalabrine expanded his journeyman's job description more than somewhat. Not only did he draw out the Sixers' defense by tossing in three-pointers, he led the game in full-length dives after loose balls.
Yeah, you want to be aggressive. You want to stay on your 2 feet as much as possible, but sometimes you just get tangled up and you fall down. But for me, it's just about being aggressive and coming out with that aggressive mindset, because that's what it takes to succeed at the highest level, not at the summer league.
This particular evening of basketball did not end for Brian Scalabrine after he'd done his job. Following the Nets-Sixers encounter, the Boston Celtics played the Cleveland Cavaliers, the team hoping to ride number one draft pick LeBron James out of obscurity and into the playoffs. And Brian Scalabrine, like most of his teammates, stayed around to watch the guy most of the 2,500 fans in the UMass gym had come to see. Scalabrine supposed that whoever might have to guard James would have an opportunity to boost his own stock.
Well, I think defensively, if you can step up to the challenge of stopping him, he's obviously the highest-touted rookie, to me, in my opinion, ever to play the game. You're going to make a name for yourself, and hopefully that can get you an NBA contract and give you a chance.
James may be the most highly-touted rookie ever. He's certainly the most highly paid. Forget his line on the Cavaliers' payroll printout. Just a few months out of high school, he's already got a $90 million contract with Nike. Among the fans who, like Brian Scalabrine, got their first look at LeBron James live on Monday night was a bandana-bedecked young man named Fredo from Mattapan, Massachusetts. He seemed to know what James would be up against.
They're coming after him. But I think that's what he's going to have to show you know, where he is really. I mean, are you really worth all this money? Because if you are, you're going to have to show us. And if he shows us, he's going to be better than 90% of these guys out here.
Is anybody worth all that money?
Yeah. Yeah. Out of high school, tough to say. Tough to say, but hopefully all goes well.
All did go reasonably well with LeBron James on Monday night, except for the final score. Despite his 25 points, 9 rebounds, 5 assists, and 2 blocked shots, the Cavaliers fell to the Celts by 3. The next morning, James got on a plane for California in order to attend ESPN's award ceremonies. His departure might have disappointed folks with tickets to see the Cavs' Summer League game on Wednesday, but 76ers assistant coach Chris Ford contended that anybody who had squeezed into the packed UMass gym just to see King James was missing the point of the Summer League experience.
Each young man out there is trying to fulfill his dream. You know, LeBron, yeah, he's pretty well set with his dreams, but these other young men are out there battling for jobs and the opportunity to play in the NBA. So much is thrown at these guys in a very short period of time. But, you know, how can they adapt? Can they figure things out quickly? Can they be receptive to teaching? And, you want to see what their physical skills are as well. And then you make your decision whether or not to bring them back to the big camp.
The best of the scrappers active in Boston's brief summer league, guys who'd no more leave town after game one than they would tie their sneakers together before taking the court, will indeed be invited to the NBA training camps at the end of the summer. There they'll try to win the opportunity to sit on an NBA team's bench and learn still more about the game they've been striving to master since somebody first noticed they were unusually quick, big, gifted, and driven. On Monday, free diver Tanya Streeter will spend several minutes breathing deeply to oxygenate her blood before she dives 106 meters, or nearly 350 feet, into the Atlantic Ocean without the aid of a breathing device. If all goes according to plan, Streeter will then drop her weights and kick to the surface under her own oxygen-deprived power. Variable ballast free diving, which is what this challenge is called, is the only free diving discipline for which Streeter has never held the world record. Tanya Streeter joins me now from the Turks and Caicos Islands, where she'll try for her newest world record. Tanya, welcome to Only a Game.
Hi, thank you.
I have to start by asking, why do you do this? Why do you free dive?
My rhetoric answer for that is, why climb the mountain? You know, it's one of those things that I enjoy doing very much, and in the environment that I love to be in the ocean, I found a way to really grow and develop myself and, you know, to accept challenges, and it was fantastic. I grew up swimming and playing with marine life and not realizing it, but basically putting down the groundwork for a great ability in breaststroke diving.
What happens in your sport on a deep dive, and what do you have to do to return to the surface safely?
I leave the surface on what is called my sled, and the sled whizzes me down a rope as fast or as slow as I want to go because there's a brake on there. And as I go through the different atmospheres of pressure, any air spaces in my body will become compressed because you can compress gases, you can't compress fluids. I need to continuously equalize the pressure on my eardrum, and the problem arises when my lungs have compressed to the point where they will not be able to compress any further. And up to about 35 years ago, scientists believed that if we went deeper, the chest wall would collapse and the rib cage would surely implode and we would die. But of course, since then, those of us who have chosen to push human endeavor have obviously discovered within a very small area of the lungs, a degree of blood fluid will pass. And they basically self-equalize.
This is a terrifying description. I can't help but saying, I understand that during this process, your lungs become roughly the size of your fists.
Yeah. As a freediver, you know, those are the things that we have to battle. A lot of people think, oh, it's just holding your breath. But really, a lot of top freedivers can hold their breath for over 5 minutes. And for me, I train to be able to hold my breath for over 6 minutes so that I have the mental strength and the knowledge that I can do a dive that's going to take me a little over three.
Tanya, the one discipline, as I understand it, that you won't be taking a shot at this time around is no limits diving, for which you briefly held the world record last summer. In October, Audrey Mestre died in her attempt to break that record. Do you worry about your own safety?
Never. No, I never have any cause to worry about my own safety because I operate within the very strict guidelines of the governing body of the sport. And in the case of Audrey's death, I would have to say that about 95% of the safety procedures were completely ignored. Mm. And Audrey was sent on a completely perilous dive due to the negligence of her team and of the governing body that they were working under. I have never felt more inspired to go out and do another dive than after Audrey died, because I needed to prove for our sport and to a degree for Audrey that this could be something that could be done completely safely, and it can be. It hit home very hard with me that somebody died trying to break a record that I had, because I really have never cared enough about a world record to ever, you know, throw caution to the wind like that.
One of the things that I've noticed in getting to be at least a little bit familiar with your sport is that records don't last very long. As soon as one is broken, somebody takes the challenge to go down and break that one. Are you and the other divers involved in this sport close to reaching the limits of what's possible, do you think?
I don't believe we're anywhere near close. I think that at some point somebody will come along who's truly gifted and will make it look like we were, you know, we were just playing in the shallows. 30 years ago when they were setting world records, those world records that they set 30 years ago are training depths for us now. Hmm. The most important thing to realize is that everything that happens in a freediver's body is human physiology at its, you know, most advanced. We are entirely capable of holding our breath for that long, and we are entirely capable of withstanding pressure that in World War I crushed submarines. We are, because we've chosen to see if we can find out. But I obviously accept that at some point there is going to be a limit, in so much as I accept that, you know, at some point sprinters are just not going to be able to run the 100 meters in under 5 seconds. You know, but look how fast they're doing it now. And it's equipment, and it's finding another little muscle fiber to train that is all important. And I think that freediving will evolve and develop in the same way.
Tanya Streeter's record attempt is scheduled for Monday. Tanya, I wish you triumphant and successful dives, and thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks, Bill. I've enjoyed it.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. Presented with a $4,265.57 repair bill for one of his automobiles, a 1961 convertible, former pro football and Major League Baseball star Deion Sanders said, "Praise Jesus, I follow what in my heart I'm told to pay," and gave the garage owner a check for only $1,500. The attorney suing Sanders for the remaining $2,765.57 scoffed at Sanders' response, calling it the Praise Jesus discount. But on Monday, a judge ruled in favor of Sanders after one of his associates testified that he had stipulated a $1,500 ceiling on the cost of the repairs. "I'm not hurting for money," Sanders said. "I could have written the check a long time ago, but I'm tired of getting ripped off."
I'm Bob C. with these sports headlines. In yesterday's American League action, Baltimore edged Anaheim 6-5. Toronto bettered Boston 4-1. The Yankees clobbered Cleveland 10-4, and Tampa Bay toppled Texas 2-0. Elsewhere, Chicago beat Detroit 7-5, Minnesota beat Oakland 3-2, and Achiro launched a two-out grand slam with two outs in the ninth to down Kansas City 6-3. For Only a Game, I'm Bob C. in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, it's Ken Jellyleg Schulman versus the Alps in Stage 8 of the Tour de France. But first, Lance Armstrong finished strongly enough in yesterday's time trials at the Tour de France to hang on to the yellow jersey. Germany's Jan Ullrich sprinted to second overall. Nearly 2 weeks ago, American racer Tyler Hamilton fractured his collarbone in two places in the Tour's first stage, but he has remained in the race and is currently in fourth place going into today's Stage 13. I spoke with Tyler's father, Bill Hamilton, after yesterday's time trial, and I asked him if the reports were correct that Tyler now has more injuries to deal with.
This is true. You know, it sounds like a pinched nerve in the back, which 2 days ago was very serious, and we thought that might cause him to withdraw. It was just excruciating pain. But he's in the hands of some miracle workers. I mean, there's a physiotherapist that accompanies the team and has been spending all of his time with Tyler. And this guy just knows how to, from the outside, open up what's inside the body and to cause it to heal. And apparently the pain in the from the pinched nerve is now no longer or much subsided. And he put in an awesome time trial today and has moved up to fourth place overall.
On Saturday, the Tour returns to the mountains, four stages in the Pyrenees. Is Tyler going to be able to meet this challenge?
Bill, like I said, we take it a day at a time. We just hope the miracles continue. Pyrenees are going to be very, very tough, not just on Tyler, but on all the riders. They're just brutal, brutal climbs, where obviously our hearts are going to be with him. But, yeah, it could mean that it's going to be the straw that breaks the camel's back. We'll have to see.
Now, Bill, strangely enough, not everybody is responding positively to Tyler's race. On Thursday, he was put in a very strange position of having to deny rumors that he didn't have a broken collarbone at all. And Stephen Roach, who won the Tour de France back in 1987, suggested that if Tyler continues to race through this much pain, the public will begin to question what kinds of drugs riders are taking, presumably to enable them to do that. This type of response has to be a little demoralizing under the circumstances.
I don't think it bothers him a bit because he knows it's untrue. And I think Stephen Roach is to be laughed at. if you go on Tyler's website and check out his guest book, which takes hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of visitors every day, every other one is saying, what kind of a jerk is this guy, Stephen Roach?
Mm-hmm.
There are always this kind of stuff. When somebody does well, particularly in American way, they're always looking for, you know, the how comes. Because obviously he can't do this by himself, right?
Now, pain is nothing new to Tyler. He raced in last year's Tour with a broken shoulder, and reports I've read say that the pain at that point was so bad that he ground his teeth and needed a dozen caps when he got home. Have you guys already made dental appointments this time around?
Well, we may have to. We may have to. I'm sure that his dentist is rubbing his hands with glee.
He's got kids that he needs to send through college, too. So.
Yes, that's right.
One British commentator has described Tyler's courage as, quote, another episode in the story of quixotic sporting heroism. Is Tyler tilting at windmills here, or do you think he really has a chance of finishing at the top of the standings?
Well, he moved up today into fourth place,
mm-hmm.
and if he can hold his own through the mountains, the chance of being second or third, things happen. As long as Lance Armstrong remains in form, he's awfully hard to beat, Bill. But accidents can happen, you know, heaven forbid. Bicycles can break down. Things can happen. I think Tyler is certainly a contender to be on the podium, providing he can get through the pain in the upcoming climbs.
Your son is a superb athlete, a great competitor. He's won numbers of races in Europe himself. Is it frustrating that this sport gets so relatively little attention compared to other pro sports here in this country?
I guess it's understandable. We have so many things here in the U.S., you know, the three big ones with football, baseball, basketball, and you have hockey. And in Europe, there are really two, possibly three big ones. One is cycling, the other is soccer, and the third would probably be ski racing.
Mm-hmm.
These are the big ones. So, I mean, what he's competing in right now is the Super Bowl of cycling.
Bill Hamilton is Tyler Hamilton's dad. Tyler's currently in fourth place on the Tour de France. Bill, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill. Enjoy being here.
Golf has its St. Andrews and Augusta National. Tennis has its Wimbledon. But for bike racing, Olympus can be found on the Alpe d'Huez, a dramatic glacial peak in the southern French Alps. The grueling 14-kilometer or 8.6-mile climb separates peddlers from posers, athletes from also-rans. This year, in its centenary, the Tour de France once again wound along the steep slopes of Alpe d'Huez, as did only a game's Ken Schulman, who packed up his 18 speed and flew to France to take on one of cycling's toughest climbs.
There are four categories of climbs in cycling. Category 4 climbs are moderately hard. Category 3 climbs are very hard. Category 2 climbs are extremely hard. And Category 1 climbs are unspeakably hard. And then there are climbs like the Alpe d'Huez, which are known as hors catégorie. Climbs that are so hard they don't even have a category. The Alpe d'Huez is 8.6 miles of unmitigated ascent with a vertical gain of more than 3,700 feet. The first 4 kilometers are the hardest, with steep pitches that peak at 14 degrees. There are 21 switchbacks, each one named for a winner of the classic Tour stage. The first switchback, curve number 21, bears the names of Fausto Coppi, who won the stage in 1952, and Lance Armstrong, King of the Hill in the 2001 edition. The road is lined with campers and trailers from all over Europe. Fans come to stake their claims days in advance of today's stage. People sleep in tents, in cars, on chaise lounges. A few are still stretched out on cardboard boxes, flattened out on the road shoulder.
Bonjour, comment vous appelez-vous?
Gilbert.
At switchback number 16, I meet Gilbert Herbe, a 55-year-old electrical engineer from Strasbourg, France. He's biking up, but he stopped to rest on the guardrail and to check his heart monitor. He says he likes cycling because it fills his heart with joy.
I'm a cycling fanatic. I've followed the sport forever and practiced it for 30 years. It's always been my dream to try and climb Alpe d'Huez. This year, when vacation rolled around, I told my wife that we were coming here. It's hard, but I've trained for this. I go slowly at my own pace.
It's hard to find your own pace on Alpe d'Huez. Go too fast and you burn out. Go too slow and your legs tighten up. Italy's Marco Pantani set the course record in 1997 with a time of 37 minutes and 35 seconds. Good amateur riders boast if they hit the top in under an hour. Most riders are happy to simply complete the climb. At switchback number 10, my legs are jelly. My gloves feel like greasy sponges. If I can still trust my eyes, I see a Frenchman playing Monopoly with his two young sons on a folding bridge table perched precariously against the guardrail. There's a lot to see on the Alpe d'Huez Road, assuming you're not in oxygen debt. Although the road is officially closed to traffic today, there are plenty of official cars heading towards the finish line. Look up from your handlebars and you see the 9,000-foot peaks of the Massif des Grandes Rousses. Look down and you see the stencils and logos and flags that transform the mountain road into a glacier of graffiti. Alain Richard, Forza Gilberto, Tyler Rocks. But the more you climb, the less you see. By switchback number 6, all you hear is your own breathing. You don't think about getting to the top. You think about getting one more lungful. You keep on pedaling, forget where and even who you are, and then, almost before you know it, you've reached the top.
Allez, allez, allez! Yeah.
There I catch up with Ben Oberge, a 31-year-old engineer from Koblenz, Germany, who passed me on curve number 9 like I was tied to a tree. He says biking up Alpe d'Huez makes him appreciate the racers even more.
I like to see how fast these racers can ride in the mountains, in the same mountains that I've ridden in. There is absolutely no comparison. They go so much faster than I can, and I've only done this climb. When they get here, they have done over 200 kilometers. It's simply unimaginable.
Everything looks beautiful on the summit of Alpe d'Huez. The newspaper delivery truck hawking a special edition of L'Equipe. The square ceramic fountain where dozens of spent bikers refill their long empty water bottles. Even the empty stands and the giant jumbotron look like bursts of edelweiss and lavender to eyes still burning from sweat and sunblock. Then, half an hour after I arrive, Gilbert Herbe, the 55-year-old Frenchman, finally pedals over the top.
C'est mon rêve. Je suis heureux comme un gamin.
I'm happy as a child. This was my dream. It took me a long while, but I finally realized it. For the past 12 years, I've had to walk on crutches, so this is even more of an accomplishment for me. I've finally realized my dream.
Donc, pour moi, c'est un exploit.
If the morning's procession of bicycles resembles a mule train, the afternoon's procession of the Tour de France caravan looks like a jazzed-up Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade. Team buses, press vans, Tour de France centenary floats, and sponsor vehicles snake through an estimated 600,000 spectators who have pitched their tents, blankets, and tarps across the sacred hillside. The official riders of the Tour de France have just begun their ascent of the Col de Galibier, another climb that is hors catégorie. I settle in with a group of French and American fans near switchback number 4 and follow the race on a portable television. Richard Veronk, who won the previous day's stage, has a 2.5-minute lead over defending champion Lance Armstrong. But Armstrong and his U.S. postal teammates are closing the gap. At 4:30, the first two helicopters appear in the valley below. It's a sign that the lead group has arrived. By now, the battery-powered television is out of juice. By rumor, we hear that Veronk has fallen off the pace and that Lance Armstrong and his teammates are leading the charge up the hill. The racers are still too far away to see. The helicopter draws nearer. Volleys of applause rifle below and spiral upwards with the rider. We hear the sound of motorcycles, the sound of cheers, and then the lead rider emerges. But it's not Armstrong. It's Iban Mayo, a Basque from Spain, riding for the Euskaltel team. For Mayo, this is only the second Tour de France. He's never won a stage before. Buoyed by the crowd, Mayo pushes harder and crosses the finish line nearly 2 minutes before the second rider, Alexander Vinokourov of Kazakhstan. Lance Armstrong arrives 2 minutes and 12 seconds back. His time is still good enough to take the Mayo Jean, the yellow leader's jersey. But the star of the day is Mayo, who adds his name to those of Coppi and Armstrong and Hinault and the other giants of Alpe d'Huez. At the post-race press conference, Mayo's words are the same as those of Gilbert Herbe. This was my dream. It took a while, but now I've realized it. The following morning, after 219 kilometers and two hors catégorie climbs, 180 tired riders line up at the start in Bourg-Bressan for another day of cycling that will take them 184 kilometers over two more hills to Gap. Many more kilometers and many more climbs lie between them and the Arrivée in Paris on July 27th. For a few, like Lance Armstrong or Iban Mayo, this Tour de France could represent a chance to make a lifelong dream come true. But for most of the riders in the world's most famous race, and most of the riders who take on Alpe d'Huez, the only dream is to make it to the finish line. For Only a Game, I'm Ken Schulman in Alpe d'Huez, France.
If you'd like to see some photographs of Ken Schulman's visit to Alpe d'Huez, visit our website, onlyagame.org. You're listening to Only a Game. Among the emails this week was an expression of disappointment from a WBUR listener, Carlotta Tyler. She felt my discussion with Charlie Pierce about the possibility that Kobe Bryant of the Los Angeles Lakers might be charged with sexual assault was off the mark. quote, "When I listen to your show," she wrote, "what I hear reflected is an often white, steadily male-centered view. This can be mitigated by having a female co-host, preferably one who has accessed her, quote, authentic female, end quote, voice." Our most plaintive email came from Bill Tucker. "You have such a great show," he wrote. "While on Cape Cod this summer, I listened faithfully. Please, please, please somehow get the show on audible.com so I can hear it when I go home to Nepal." Don West of Plattsburgh, New York, was less enamored of last week's program, which included my conversation with Ken Shulman, who spoke to me from the Tour de France. "So," Mr. West wrote, "you are just like the rest of them. You feel the need to say something about the tour, even though you don't know anything about it. So you contact some correspondent who's being paid to take his ego trip to go over and ride some of the climbs. Why don't you find somebody who's willing to do his homework and educate the public?" Edward Cowan of Washington, D.C., wrote to say that he'd found last week's story about the dwindling number of bat companies supplying Major League Baseball, quote, "an interesting item, but he thought I left a lot of questions unanswered. Has Major League Baseball decided that the disclaimer on the ticket might not hold up in court?" he asked. "In a follow-up story, you might examine more closely this legal angle, and you might skip the populist demonology about Hillrick and Bradsby, quote, clubbing Major League Baseball to punish its small competitors." Finally, Chuck Strins of Eagan, Minnesota, who characterizes himself as, quote, "a devoted fan," wrote to express his frustration at temporarily failing to connect to the Only a Game archives. "Must I miss my Charlie Pierce?" he emailed. He added, "I grew up in Nebraska in a vehement but small contingent that hates sports, although I must say you guys seem to be turning me." Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. You can reach us through our website, onlyagame.org. Palpable Mail will find us at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company, with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment. On the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter, McLennan & Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Senior citizens dance in Miami's Little Havana. Horns blare in the bombed-out streets of Kosovo. And steel drums ring below Broadway and a New York subway platform. I'm Scott Simon. These sounds of our world on Weekend Edition Saturday from NPR News.
I'm Bob C. with these sports headlines. In yesterday's National League action, Montreal downed Philadelphia 3-1. Pittsburgh vanquished Milwaukee 7-2. Houston stifled Cincinnati 5-3. Atlanta beat the Mets 11-4. And Florida flummoxed the Cubs 6-0. Elsewhere, Los Angeles topped St. Louis 8-5. Arizona shut out San Diego 6-0. And San Francisco triumphed over Colorado 7-0. For Only a Game, I'm Bob C. in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a soccer tournament with a different goal. But first, Charlie Pierce joins me for a look at the week's sports news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The NBA's free agency signing period began on Wednesday. Have you a candidate for team most improved over the last 4 days?
Yeah, I think the team that improved itself the most is the Indiana Pacers, who re-signed Jermaine O'Neal against all odds for 7 years and $120 million. That has been pretty much the compelling dynamic in the free agency signing period, is that a lot of teams re-sign their own people.
Among them, New Jersey, re-signing Jason Kidd, and they may have improved themselves by doing that, also by adding Alonzo Mourning. But the Nets apparently will not offer head coach Byron Scott the contract extension that he would like. Is the team kind of working against itself that way?
Well, that's going to be the happy, happy, joy, joy locker room of all time, isn't it? How does Byron Scott possibly at this point have any authority in that locker room? Jason Kidd has signed for 6 years. Alonzo Mourning has signed a multi-year deal that runs probably 4 years. He can't even get an extension for 1 year. Who is management going to listen to if things go wrong this year?
Charlie, the free agency period will continue through the month. So here's the burning question of the day and perhaps the month. Where does Dennis Rodman end up?
You know, I don't know that the NBA needs Dennis Rodman at age 42 to come back. Although he does say that the way he left wasn't right, which I don't think anyone can disagree with. You know, he came back to the Pacers when he was 40, or tried to, and they said his roster was full. The guy can still rebound. It's probably all he can do. But I can't imagine a franchise taking a chance on this guy.
On Thursday, Tiger Woods began the British Open by having one of those holes that encourages most golfers to just put an X in the little box on the scorecard. Not an option open to Tiger during the British Open. Has he ever begun a tournament more haplessly?
Oh, come on. He only hit a 7. There's a guy who had an 11 on that hole.
Yeah, but he lost his drive, for goodness sake.
Well, yeah, and it was graceless. Tiger is developing it. Tiger is developing a nasty habit of blaming the underlings when things go wrong. His caddy did this. Somebody overclubbed him. Now he's yelling at 4 caddies who make, you know, 4 pence a week to stand out in the gorse and the heather, try to find his golf ball. I have to admit, I'd never conceived that the opening drive of a golf tournament, a major golf tournament, by the most famous golfer in the world, would just sort of get lost.
Ohio State University is investigating possible preferential academic treatment for football star Maurice Claret. Charlie, the associate professor who administered an oral exam after Claret had walked out on his midterm, claims that other former students have also been allowed to do this. I wonder how many of those students wear shoulder pads and cleats to work.
Well, we don't know, but I think we're going to find out. The question is it within university policy? It seems to be. This is not dissimilar from the academic program that was set up for Patrick Ewing when he went to Georgetown, untimed test, oral exams, and so forth. If this teacher is actually trying to help him learn the material in this course, I don't have a problem with this, and I don't think anyone else should either.
FIFA, soccer's governing body, recently banned both male and female players from taking off their shirts to celebrate their goals or wins. This week, Brandi Chastain, who's been known to celebrate that way on occasion, said that she would take off her shirt again if the U.S. won the Women's World Cup, and she cited the need for spontaneity in celebrations. You want to help me with the logic here?
Well, it's very much like the opinion of those people who think nonconformity is all right as long as we all do it at the same time.
A Bulgarian football, a.k.a. soccer club, has announced plans to build a chapel next to its grounds because, quote, the religious culture of young people is not at the necessary level. So what do we see next? A mosque next to Dodger Stadium?
Well, I mean,
a synagogue inside of Camden Yards next to Boog's Barbecue?
Certainly the religious culture of young people at soccer stadiums is not at the necessary level. We can agree to that. I just hope people don't start, like, tearing the pews out of the floor and beating each other over the head with it.
Australian Cathy Freeman, the 400-meter gold medalist at the Sydney Olympics, announced her retirement this week. She cited what is, I think, the best reason in the world for that decision, don't you think?
Yeah, she doesn't want to run anymore.
Exactly. I'm tired. I don't want to do it anymore.
I mean, it's not dissimilar to the argument that Jim Brown made when he walked away from the NFL at what people would perceive to be the peak of his career, or that Barry Sanders has made subsequently.
Mm-hmm.
It is a little bit understandable. She's an Olympic champion, which is as high as it gets. gets in her particular sport. She had a huge moment in Sydney, one of the signature moments of the Olympic Games. It's not so much I'm not sure that she doesn't feel like running anymore, that she doesn't feel like winning anymore. She just doesn't want to put in the effort it takes to get to that level again. And in so many ways, she reached the peak of her sport that I'm frankly not surprised.
Singapore has hit upon an interesting way to try to, quote, encourage creativity and grow its economy. Charlie, the government will henceforth allow bungee jumping. Think it'll work?
Well, I mean, they also permitted bar patrons to dance outside designated dance areas, including on bar tops. I mean, they're liberalizing society a little bit. I didn't realize that Singapore was this great untapped bungee jumping market, but apparently it is.
Meanwhile, there's shame and scandal in the sumo wrestling community.
Ow.
The guy who may be the best sumo wrestler in the world has apparently disgraced himself as well as his sport by employing a standard WWE move. I'm not sure what all the fuss is about.
Yes, the grand champion, Asa Shoryu, who is 22 years old and oddly enough from Mongolia, proving that the influx of foreign athletes affects more than the National Basketball Association. Unfortunately, he was disqualified for grabbing his opponent's top knot and yanking him into the dirt. I don't know if you've seen
it's his hair.
It's a very ceremonial, very part of the culture of the sport. But the headline in the largest newspaper in Japan read, "Top knot grabber? Unheard of." I can't think of anything I'd like to be called less in a newspaper with a circulation of 13 million than top knot grabber.
And finally, Cuddly Truckee, the mascot of Osaka's Hanshin Tigers baseball team, has been incorporated into the design of a bra for Tigers fans. Can these fuzzy little fellows elevate the perennially hapless Tigers over the hated Yomiuri Giants?
See, Bill, I have never been more grateful in the almost 10 years we've been doing this show that Only a Game is a radio show. Because otherwise, an image of this particular foundation garment would be looming about 9 feet tall over your head, and you would be blushing and stammering. It would be very hard to. Very hard to carry on. Yes, this is something that no thinking human being should ever put on their body at any time. Actually, and I'll tell you one thing, and it goes a long way to explain top knot grabbing. Let me tell you.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine and provides a lift each week here on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
No, let go! Let go!
Late yesterday afternoon, Eagle County District Attorney Mark Hurlburt announced that Los Angeles Lakers guard Kobe Bryant has been charged with one count of felony sexual assault on a 19-year-old woman on June 30th at the resort near Vail, Colorado, where Bryant was staying and where the woman was employed. Through his attorneys, Bryant issued a statement yesterday. It read in part, "Nothing that happened on June 30th was against the will of the woman who now falsely accuses me. I made the mistake of adultery." Bryant will next be required to appear in court on August 6th. If he is convicted, he faces 4 years to life in prison. Last week, the host country took first place in the Homeless World Cup, which took place in Graz, Austria. The tournament, created to help the homeless reintegrate into society and to raise public awareness about homelessness, drew teams from 16 countries. The long-shot United States team, nicknamed the New Yorkers, fared well against the world's best homeless soccer players. WHYY's Ian Chillog has our report.
You know that old sports cliche, the team just didn't show up? As the 2003 Homeless World Cup begins, the cliche literally applies. It's just minutes before an important qualifying match between the U.S. and Slovakia, and U.S. team manager Ron Grunberg can't find his team.
They have not shown up yet. As a matter of fact, right behind you, our director's calling the coach on her phone as to where in the city their march has taken them.
Grunberg seems to understand that this isn't about ego or laziness. The U.S. team members are guys from the street who don't often have a place to be, anyone depending on them, or any reason to look at a watch.
Here's the U.S. team. They're here.
Finally, a minute before tip-off, the team arrives. It's been a struggle just to make it to Austria. The U.S. team spent the last several months securing passports, fundraising, and for some of the players, learning to play soccer. No one's expecting them to win many games. New Yorker Triton McEwen ended up on the street when he was 16. He played soccer for the first time 2 months ago.
In New York, I mean, they don't play soccer a lot. We're mostly good for basketball and football and things like that, and baseball. So soccer was like, when they said soccer team, I was like, soccer team? We don't have a soccer team. Like, where's this going on?
The Homeless World Cup is held this year in a square in the center of Graz, Austria, on a court built just for the tournament. Street soccer is played on cement in a space smaller than a tennis court. It's surrounded by grandstands and giant nets protecting the crowd. They play 3-on-3 plus a goalie on each side. Fast 7-minute halves produce scores like 10-8, 7-6. Slovakia plays the U.S. tough, and it's 5-all after regulation, going to penalty kicks. Goalie Rory Levine, toothpick in mouth, faces down the first attacker. Levine, who lost his job after the September 11th attacks, stops the first penalty kick. The star of the New Yorkers, Ecuadorian immigrant Eric Riviera, shoots next for the U.S. He fakes left, shoots right, and he's stonewalled by the Slovakian goalie. The U.S. team looks nervous. It's up to Harris Pankin, a bearded and sometimes overly competitive former punk rocker. He walks casually towards the goal, stretches his arms to the sky, fakes a yawn, and shoots. The U.S. wins in overtime and makes it to the quarterfinals.
Blood the New Yorkers!
Jeff Grunberg is executive director of Grand Central Neighborhood, the New York City area outreach group that assembled the U.S. team. He tries to do a little coaching after the game, but Eric Riviera has other concerns.
Diego needs to spread, because if he doesn't spread out, he can't score for you.
Yeah.
He gets in the middle, it's no good. He's got to stay out on the side.
There's no sandwich to eat or something.
Watching the games, you almost forget what you're seeing. Homeless people playing soccer. But coaching a homeless soccer team means being a strategist, an administrator, and sometimes a social worker and a therapist. Stephanie Quinn is head coach of the U.S. team.
A game is a lot like life. There's a lot of pressure situations, and there's good times and there's bad times, and you have to deal with them all. And so I constantly try to stress to them how much this experience is like life. Look, you don't always want to show up to practice, but you did, and so now you're in Austria. Just like you might not want to show up to work every day, but if you do, you have your own house, you know, and that's what you want ultimately.
Triton McEwen would rather dispense with the metaphors.
I just like to play. I'm not going to be like, soccer's going to make me want to get close to family. No, it's nothing emotional like that. It's just, I enjoy it.
The teams at the tournament all have different soccer styles. There's the Brazilians, young kids from the Rio slums who play the beautiful game. An Austrian team, which is actually a group of asylum seekers from Africa. And England, clean-cut men coached by two guys from Manchester United. On the other hand, the Swiss team sports pot bellies and scraggly beards, and it features a woman, Aussie, a mohawked, pierced, spike-wearing punk, whom it appears only plays soccer to pass the time between cigarettes.
There's just a problem with, how to say this, spikes.
Yeah.
The spikes I have to take away from me when I play. They look... because it's no fair playing with these spikes.
Yeah, you can do some damage.
Yeah.
By the tournament's third day, some of these players have become local stars. They're mobbed by kids wanting autographs. Female spectators write their phone numbers on the players' jerseys, apparently unaware that most of these guys don't even have phones. After the U.S. win over Slovakia, I find New Yorker German Santiago surrounded by three women, and he's delighted.
Dile que estamos muy felices porque el partido de Nueva York está ganando.
Yeah, they're very happy because we're winning.
All right.
Jeff Grunberg stands nearby, looking like a proud parent.
I think the reason that the fans, and especially the women, are falling in love with our players is they're seeing our players at their best. This is the kind of, if back home, if they were achieving this much, they'd have this many women coming at them also. They're great guys.
But the quarterfinals aren't so kind to the New Yorkers. After seeing Slovakia crushed by Holland and Austria by scores of 21-0 and 26-0, the U.S. loses 5-2 to a talented South African team. They go on to finish ninth in the tournament with a 7-6 record. It's a victory of sorts for these underdogs among underdogs, and the crowd shows its appreciation. Mo Stevenson and Greg Joseph, two players from England's team, were spotted by talent scouts at the Homeless World Cup and will train with club teams back in their home country. But there will be no such successes for the members of the U.S. team. They've been huge stars for a week. Soon they'll head back to New York, where they're still homeless, where people avoid them. But Jeff Grunberg hopes they will return to the U.S. with a new perspective.
The juxtaposition between the noise, the adulation, and the comeback versus their loneliness back home, maybe it will strike them. Oh, my God, I really do have to do something different with my life. I want some more of that good stuff. So who knows how it's going to go? We'll be there to watch it, to intervene and to give them pep talks and try to keep them going on the up, on the upswing. But we're there for them if there's a bit of a downswing, too, like we've been for them since day one.
Eric Riviera will continue playing street soccer once he returns to the States. But for now, he isn't looking too far beyond the immediate rewards of the Homeless World Cup.
Everyone has a bed to sleep in, and we had like 3 meals a day, which was amazing. Mostly we don't have those kind of, most of us, we don't have those kind of treatment. But here, everyone is treated as great, and it's been a big surprise. This is like being, you know, like somebody who's rich. Yeah. Like a rich man, yeah.
For Only a Game, I'm Ian Chillog in Graz, Austria.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Michael Garth. We had help this week from Pippin Ross and from Bello LaSource. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for the Only a Game newsletter or view Ken Schulman's Tour de France photo journal, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from free diver Tanya Streeter, who doesn't have to worry about big shoe company endorsement deals because when she dives, she doesn't wear any shoes.
No, but they could sponsor me if they wanted to. Anybody from Nike listening?
So, no swooshing dolphins or jellyfish. Score one for the barefoot set. Though I'll state here that Ms. Streeter is definitely worth LeBron Jamesian cabbage. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.